Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to the Mobilities and Methods series hosted by the New Books Network in association with Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Mobilities and Methods Lab and New Books Network partnership provide a platform for authors, readers, and their interlocutors to engage closely with questions of mobility and movement. My name is Lakshita Malik, and today I'm joined by Dr. Minha T. Pham, professor at the graduate program in media studies at the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, New York. We are in conversation about her book, Why We Can't Have Nice Things, Social Media's Influence on Fashion, Ethics, and Property, published by Duke University Press in 2022. We look forward to hearing from Dr. Pham. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
That's fabulous. I'm going to jump right in. So it's a very fascinating book. I'm going to let you lead on that. Could you tell us a little bit about the book, how the project came about, and what specifically about fashion ethics intrigued you in conversation with social media?
Oh, great. How did the project come about? As so many of my projects do, it's quite organic. I am on social media a lot, probably too much. And so I'm really interested, because I'm a scholar of culture, you know, cultural studies, race and gender, I'm always kind of on the lookout for those kinds of things, right? But because I'm on the internet so much, I started to realize, I started to see that there was this kind of phenomenon that was happening, right? That I later coined as crowdsourced intellectual property regulation. But basically what that means is that I started to see social media users and fashion brands and fashion designers encouraging, if not recruiting, social media users to call out knockoff artists, fashion knockoff artists, or knockoff brands, right? So, and oftentimes you started to see trends where only certain kinds of brands and certain kinds of knockoffs were being called out, right? And so I became very interested in the way that the fashion industry, fashion brands have used digital media, have used the internet in particular, to reorganize the supply chain, to reorganize global fashion markets, to reorganize global trade and global capitalism, right? This is what I was doing in my first book. My first book is on Asian super bloggers. I'm looking at the rise of Asian super bloggers and thinking about how this particular group of very successful personal style bloggers can tell us about the ways that race and gender and class are integral to how the fashion industry kind of reproduces itself, right? Like, how does it rely on certain kinds of racialized and gendered labor now that we're in this kind of fashion internet economy. So the idea, the questions of labor and fashion, global fashion capitalism and the internet are really kind of the intersection where I'm working. In this book, I expand it to consider how other kinds of consumers, not consumers that think of themselves as bloggers, but just regular, ordinary consumers are kind of being called upon it and think of themselves as being called upon to act, to help brands go after knockoffs, right? And so again, this becomes this kind of consumer labor becomes a new sector, a new node in the supply chain, a new sector of workers that the fashion industry can extract labor from, right? And of course, all of this is done voluntarily. It's unwaged labor. It's very casualized labor. And so in some ways, this is a very new phenomenon. But if we look at the kind of history of fashion capitalism, right, the kind of low-wage worker or the no-wage worker, the casualization of labor, et cetera, we're not seeing anything new. We're just seeing that digital media has allowed global capital and global fashion in particular to kind of expand the scope of its ability to extract labor. Now, what's new about it is that it's extracting this labor under the cover of things like, ethical fashion, right? A call for ethical fashion and that consumers feel like they have a responsibility to make this industry, to help this industry out, right? This $1 trillion industry, right? And that's really fascinating to me. So I'm really interested in how, the idea of work is being reorganized in the internet age, how the idea specifically of fashion work is being reimagined in ways that actually don't resolve any kinds of inequalities, but actually harden those inequalities.
Mm-hmm. No, the ideas about work are very, it's very obvious in your text. It's intentionally there, this idea of uncompensated yet voluntary labor, which consumers, but not really consumers, because they're also, producing their own capital alongside these brands. And so it's a complicated view of all of these. And I really appreciated the way that you'd structured it. And I come to some of those questions around how you view social media behavior. But before we get into that, I really want to get into the first example you share in your text, which is looking at the controversy around the originality of a particular design that Forever 21 had put out. And like you said in your opening remarks around crowdsourced intellectual property regulation, could you speak to that a little bit in terms of how, because that example really sets the tone for the rest of the text. It's complicated and really sets the tone.
Yeah, crowdsourced IP regulation is, so I can talk about that, but I can say just kind of in broader terms, right, that becomes an example for me of liberal forms of digital activism that maybe are reproducing the kinds of harm that they intend to challenge, right? And so this is just one example. Crowdsource IP regulation. Crowdsource IP regulation, this idea that social media users, ordinary consumers, have a responsibility, right, to make the fashion market more ethical. And it's also rooted in a kind of growing and already very widespread concern that consumers have and a desire that they have for ethical fashion, right? So it's coming, it's very well intentioned. But what's happening is that as consumers are using social media platforms to call out different, brands or to help out brands that are complaining of being copied, what I saw is that the ways in which social media users understood the difference between real fashion and fake fashion, property and impropriety, creativity and copying, They're kind of frameworks for understanding, right, what a counterfeit or a fake fashion product is, was really interesting to me. And it was interesting because it echoes so much of, you know, very traditional understandings of property, right? It doesn't challenge the kinds of racial politics and the colonial histories of property, right? And so I what's really interesting is that fashion brands call upon consumers oftentimes, and oftentimes consumers take it upon themselves. But when fashion brands call upon them, what they say is, and this is the first example that you're talking about, the first case study that I look at, what they say is that the lawyers can't really help us here. First of all, the law, IP law in the United States, right, doesn't cover much of fashion design. It covers like trademarks, et cetera, but it doesn't cover the actual physical design of the product. So the law doesn't help us. The law is inadequate, right? And so brands are calling on consumers to kind of be a stopgap for what they see as an inadequacy of the law, right? The other thing that they say is that, you know, smaller designers say, well, like the first case study, Granted Clothing, which is a knitwear brand based in Vancouver, Canada, what they're saying is like, we're a small brand. We can't afford to hire lawyers, right? And a bigger brand like Forever 21 is really taking advantage of us because they're this giant international corporation. When you look at the kind of discourse around, you know, the ways that consumers are defining and brands are defining creativity versus copying, what you see again is, you know, this, there are many assumptions being made about who a designer is, what originality looks like. The first case study that I look at that opens the book shows that, yes, Forever 21 copied Granted Clothing sweater, right? And everybody and social media users were up in arms about it. There was a lot of viral outrage about it. But the fact that Granted Clothing, this Vancouver small knitwear brand, was actually copying an indigenous design didn't seem to matter to anybody, even when it was pointed out, right? And so on the one hand, this indigenous design gets imagined as a public resource, public heritage, right? Cultural heritage. Because Granted Clothing is in Vancouver, it was, you know, they saw it as, and they articulated it on their website. It's no longer there anymore, but they actually mentioned it where they would say, we're proud of this heritage, right? This Canadian heritage, and this is an homage, right? And so even the ways that, you know, the language of homage, cultural appreciation, et cetera, are ways to kind of get around, you know, the kinds of clear racial and colonial biases in property logics. And I want to be clear that the book is not that interested in arguing for, which designer is right or wrong. What I'm really interested in is the kind of logics that allow certain kinds of brands to be seen or designs to be seen as fake fashion, and for certain kinds of designs to be seen as original works, even when they're clearly copied, right? And so in the book, I talk a lot about how what we're seeing is not a kind of argument between originality and copying, but actually the debate really is between who's allowed to copy, right, and still be seen as an original designer, and who is not allowed to copy, right? And so that there's a kind of right to copy that consumers, that social media users are actually ratifying in some way, right? Kind of in this kind of popular, informal way, ratifying a right to copy for some designers, some creatives, and taking it away from others.
Mm-hmm. No, that is a, thank you so much for going into that. And that's fabulous. And that sort of brings me to this point about, and you sort of hinted at it and briefly touched upon in the previous remarks around property, right? So what is connected closely to ownership of property and how property gets socially constructed, in fact, is also related to who gets to perform the particularly creative labor, because that's the new turn in labor studies, is looking at creative labor. But you're complicating this by asking, well, wait a minute, who's actually allowed to perform what is technically creative labor? Because everything's creative, right? You take a route to school and you can't figure out, which bus it is. So you creatively improvise and you're like, oh, I'm just going to hitchhike or something like that, right? That's a poor example. But that's, everybody's doing that creative work. But at what point does that become monetized, and how that becomes implicated into these global structures is something that you're looking at. Can we go into that a little bit about how this property becomes attached to the bodies of separate stakeholders, like the very real questions of gender and race that are evoked, which you go into it with the chapter on the history where you look at FOGA and all of these different things, but it's a very complicated, there are different stakeholders, people are being incited, like you said, oh, speak up and, you know, tell us what is going on. So in the contemporary context, how do you look at property, social, like there's a lot of that stuff. So let's come back to the social construction of property and relationship to creative labor. So that's something.
I mean, the history of property in the United States, in the United States context, the history of property is you know, rooted in native genocide, right? Is rooted in, you know, the colonialism of the Americas, dispossession, native dispossession, et cetera, right? We can't get away from that. It's rooted, the history of property is also rooted in the history of slavery, right? In the United States, who is allowed to be considered property and who can never be considered property, right? So there's that. And that's a much longer history. I talk about it, you know, I do spend some time on those, that history in the book, but it's you know, even that is so cursory, right? But one of the kind of lines of this history that I do track is the racialization of property and the racialization of, in particular, thieves, right? So if you have property, then if there's such a thing as property, there has to be such a thing as a thief, right? If there's property rights, there has to be someone who is violating those rights, right, by being the thief, right? And so I look specifically today, when we think of fashion knockoffs in particular, right? Knockoff handbags, et cetera, knockoff fashion. We often think of Asians, right? Whether it's, you know, Canal Street in Chinatown in New York, in Manhattan, or it's, you know, made in China products, made in Bangladesh, made in Vietnam products, right? We think of as, you know, probably made under unethical conditions, whether that's, you know, bad labor conditions within that kind of workplace, or whether it's made, you know, as a knockoff, right? That whether it was copied. And so one of the chapters traces the history of this Asian fashion copycat, right? And it traces to this idea that, you know, the idea that Asians are imagined, particularly in the U.S., but this is you know, widespread too. The idea that Asians are often imagined as not having any capacity for creativity. You know, Asians take instructions well. Asians work hard. Asians are good at doing repetitive labor, right? But Asians are not creative. They're not problem solvers. They don't take initiative. They're not self-expressive. They have no soul, right? So all of those kind of cultural stereotypes help shape this idea, help shape now the knockoff economy, right? The idea that we think of as a knockoff economy, that it couldn't possibly be that, you know, these Asians, we can't imagine them as creatives, because historically Asians have been racialized as being without the capacity for creativity. And, you know, and there's a remark I make in the book where at the very same time that we're looking at, you know, China, Vietnam, India, and different places in Asia as kind of epicenters for knockoff fashion, right? At this very moment when we're looking at, you know, we're racializing Asia as a pirate, you know, as pirate countries. The MoMA had that exhibit, right? In the MoMA had the exhibit where they looked at China's influence. This is the Looking Glass exhibit, right? They look at China's influence on Western fashion. And something that I say in the book is that many of the designs that we see at this museum exhibit could be considered knockoffs. They look like the original, right? But nobody is using the term knockoff. Nobody is talking about counterfeit. Nobody is questioning whether or not Europeans and white American designers have the capacity for creativity, right? No one is talking about the US or France or Italy being pirate nations, right? And so this is a great example of how these ideas about, you know, fake fashion or real fashion or original fashion and counterfeit fashion are actually not objective terms, right? There's no objective quality. And when the fashion industry or when, and some fashion IP lawyers, when they talk about expanding intellectual property protections to include fashion, there's always a kind of list, a laundry list of, okay, these are the criteria, right, that we would use to determine whether something is a knockoff or not, which suggests that that there's like objective qualities that make a fashion design fake or real or original or not a counterfeit. In fact, there's not, right? These are kind of racial and cultural biases that we bring to designs that reinforce, you know, higher racial hierarchies, but also geoeconomic hierarchies between different regions, the global north, the global south, et cetera.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. No, that. Thank you for that. The other question, and I'm looking at a list of questions that I have, and it may be overkill at this point, but and the following questions will look at social media in specific because that's such a huge site through which you operate. One of the things that you say, I think earlier on, is you don't call what is happening on social media. It's a larger phenomenon around branding. You stop yourself from calling it, or you say the term social media shaming and outbursts and stuff like that, and you're not interested in calling it that, right? And I assume that has to relate. In my mind, it relates to the idea of uncompensated, voluntarily performed labor that you were talking about. And it's pertinent to get into platform capitalism, and all sorts of people are making money off of this, this outrage or shaming. So I think what you do is through, you really highlight, look, the platform is not absent from all of, it's not a neutral space. So yeah, I just wanted to get into some of that, of why we look at these discourses and what is the danger of just calling them discourses that are happening.
Yeah. A lot of articles that have focused on this call it social media shaming or cancel culture, right? It's part of that kind of idea, or that it gets kind of folded into that discourse, right? I think that it's part of it. I think that it's part of it, but I think that social media outrage or social media shaming is an inadequate term, precisely for the reasons that you mentioned, right? First of all, it doesn't highlight enough, it doesn't emphasize enough that these are value-producing activities, right? They're value-producing, which is to say it's work, right? It's uncompensated work, it's unremunerated work, but it is work because it produces value, and it produces all kinds of value. It produces commercial value, but it also produces consumer values, right, around taste and what even is ethical fashion, right? So that's one reason that I think that the term social media outrage is inadequate. The other reason I think it's inadequate, and again, you've already mentioned this, is that it doesn't take seriously enough the social media, right? It doesn't take seriously enough the way that social media tools and sites aren't just, they're not just the thing that's being used to call out knockoff brands, right? It's not just the thing that's being used, but actually that social media becomes the thing that's being struggled over, right? And so what you have a lot is that right now the concern is that fashion knockoffs are, you know, just exploding everywhere precisely because the wrong people have access to social media. That is to say, you know, Chinese factories, for example, have too much access to social media. They can look at a video of a runway show, right, and zoom in 300-500%, and they can copy a design without ever without ever having it in their possession, right? And so that it isn't just that these Asian fashion copycats are kind of culturally inclined, right, to copy because they don't have the creative capacity. But the other problem is that these Asian copycats have a technical skill, right? They have this kind of technical skill without the ethical compass, right, to copy, right? So there's a lack. There's a kind of undeveloped, these aren't just undeveloped countries or developing countries, but there's a kind of underdeveloped sense of ethics, morality, an underdeveloped sense of underdeveloped appreciation for property, individual property, and so all these kinds of stereotypes kind of come together to create the kind of discourse that we're seeing now about knockoff fashion. But it's also so normalized that ordinary social media users who have no training and have no background in thinking about the politics of property or the history of property, all of this makes sense to them, right? Because these cultural stereotypes are so widespread and so pervasive that the idea that, oh, probably, you know, something made in Asia, especially if it's expensive, is going to be a knockoff. Probably that makes sense, right? It fits all kinds of stereotypes that are deeply held and deeply rooted in many cultures, but particularly in the United States.
No, that's totally right. And all of this while the US especially has the worst track record for workers' rights protections, and you see unions forming everywhere. And this is a point you bring up even in your, even the first example. It was, the garment was in fact produced, was probably produced in the US where the Forever 21 factory is, which is so interesting. So this burden of unethical consumption as well as production being associated with largely Asian bodies and appropriated from...
Absolutely. The racialization of piracy, right? And particularly the Asianization of piracy is something that is not just confined to fashion, and certainly not just confined to this moment, but that this moment, but that social media and digital media is creating kind of new, is expanding that discourse for sure, is expanding these stereotypes, but is also allowing these stereotypes to circulate in, you know, faster and wider than they had in the past. But it's, you know, it's really fascinating to me, this idea that there was a line, there was a quote that someone said, I think it was in the first case study, where the designer said, you know, these Forever 21 scouring the internet, right? And like, what does it mean to scour the internet? Obviously, what he means is that they're misusing the internet in some way, right? They're not just misusing the fashion, the design, they're misusing the internet. And so again, you see these kinds of intersections of, you know, Asians, the stereotype with Asians with high skill, technical skill, but no sense of ethics and certainly no creativity, kind of come together in this way that becomes part of the common sense about knockoff fashion, right?
Yeah. No, that's a very important point, and I think you've highlighted that with a lot of importance. And the other thing that I want to get into from this is, of course, you highlight this idea of looking and being able to zoom in. I found it so fascinating, and being able to look, people have access to social media. They're able to like look at these 360 whatever runway shows where you can, you know, with museums, you have access to all sorts of things. But what is also happening, and you look at some of the critique that social media as a platform is able to enable, that's a weird thing to say, but it provides also that space for not just looking at, but looking back, which I found so interesting. And you highlighted in, you know, the Diet Prada, but also the Thai rainbow bag is precisely what that is. And of course, it's with caveats because it's not, you know, it's also buying into some of those logics, but also critiquing it. But it's a very complicated looking back, which I found so interesting. And just wanted you to sort of go into some of the motivation behind, you know, not just that social media is all bad in terms of, you know, for the brands to manipulate, but there's something quite feral about the way in which instant messaging and instant commenting and just virality of certain things goes up. It's a precarious space for even the brands to handle, and what that allows for and what that doesn't.
Yeah. So the case study you're talking about, some Thai social media users in Thailand, are calling out Balenciaga for a tote bag that they see on the runway, a tote bag that looks a lot like kind of, you know, tote bags that can be found in Thailand. This is a great example. Social media is not just a tool, right? It's the very site of struggle over these ideas, right? Of you know, creativity versus copying. And so this is an example of that. And you know, as you point out, the Thai consumers are absolutely buying into certain ideas about intellectual property and the importance of you know, claiming anything as property, claiming any design as property. They do it from a very different vantage point than, say, Western consumers, than, say, Western brands, certainly, right? But these, again, these ideas are global at this point. The ideas that you know, we can the logics of intellectual property, Western intellectual property logics, have become very global, and we see these Thai consumers kind of embracing some of it. And so there's, you know, these kinds of crowdsourced intellectual property regulation from below, as I call it, right? From the global south or from consumers that are in the periphery of global fashion, who live in the periphery of global fashion, don't guarantee any kind of economic or social justice, right? But what they do, what these kinds of moments, these incidents do, is that they show us that the Western property regime, right? Western intellectual property logics are in fact not fixed, are not secure, can be destabilized, right? And so it shows that there's cracks in the wall, right? And that's really important. It also, for a moment, the Thai consumers, the Thai social media users, for a moment and in very limited ways, end up reversing the kind of relationship between the creative West and the copycat, you know, East, right? And so they do reverse that. They do upend that in limited ways. What I also love about the story is that the Balenciaga bag actually becomes devalued, right? Because the Thai consumers somehow have managed to turn the memes that they're creating to call out Balenciaga, these are going viral now, right? They've spread beyond Thailand. They're going viral. And so Balenciaga is now dealing with a bad PR problem. But as it's dealing with a bad PR problem, the price, the actual price of the Thai bag increases, right? I think like, you know, threefold, which is just amazing. And so the Thai bag goes from, I don't remember, like $1 to $3, right? The equivalent of like $1 to $3 or something like that. But the fact that there was this kind of increase shows again, it reminds us again that the work that these social media watchdogs are doing is in fact work. It's value producing work. But that also that in very limited ways, that the global economy, that consumers are influencing global markets and global economies and the flow of all kinds of capital, right? For very limited ways, they're reversing that flow from from the West now back to the East, and that's fascinating to me.
Yeah, no, that was absolutely such a fascinating example, and what. And this is going to be slightly tangential, but what that made me think of is this scene from Devil Wears Prada, and Miranda Priestly, which is Meryl Streep's character, is lecturing her assistant and is telling her, oh, you are laughing at this belt. And she lists us this entire like trail through which fashion percolates down from high-end runway shows to department stores to knockoffs to the streets of wherever she picked it up from. And then she lists out that, oh, actually you're wearing whatever was picked out for you by me and people like me. But what the Thai Rainbow Bag does is like, well, it's not as simple. Actually, people may have been already living in those spaces. And what these editors and magazines and brands do is also flip stuff, right? So it's not as top down as one might think. It's actually a little more complicated. And I love that story so much. And it really just hits the nail on the head. And what you said about like devalue work that devalues was also something I hadn't thought of that until you said it right now. But the work is just does not just produce value. It also produces devalue or devalues something as well. Like that's the potential that work has to, which is quite fascinating to think about. Like work that is being done that actually ruptures capitalist flows of productivity.
Yes. But also, again, because this value producing work is not remunerated, the work itself is already devalued, right? The very work that consumers are doing, the work that they're doing for free for, again, like a $3 trillion global industry, right? The ways in which consumers have come to feel protective over a $3 trillion industry is fascinating, but also a little bit alarming, right? So the work that is being done is devalued, but this is not new to social media, right? That fashion, the global fashion industry has always relied on and continues to rely on and profit from the devaluation of certain kinds of labor, right? Particularly, for example, whether it's garment workers, models, and so on, right? Kind of rank and file fashion worker, right? It's always relied on that. And again, it profits from the precarity of so much fashion work, right? Which now we can include consumer labor, right?
Mm-hmm. No, that's absolutely correct. And there was, I mean, I'm going to do like a short thing because I don't want to keep you over time. And I have a couple of questions. Just one short sort of question around method and which I thought was really interesting. The fact that all of these examples are seemingly organically coming at you. Like you said, you use social media, and the same with me. Honestly, I picked out my research site based on how much I was using social media and how much like makeup artists were coming at me. It felt like almost, it felt like they picked me instead of me picking. So how much of your own personal, this something that you were already doing that you can, you know, draw a project out of, and also, yeah, this sort of blurring of personal curiosity at, or whatever consumption it may be called, and professional, which I find so fascinating.
I mean, I think that anyone who does research on any aspect of social media, right? And again, social media is just this very small term for a huge field, right? And it, you know, a huge, diverse, heterogeneous field, right? But anyone who does research on social media, I think in some ways is already what we might call a participant observer, right? So already that's happening. My training is in structural analysis. My training is in, you know, cultural studies, like I said. My training is in cultural economy, right? And so that's kind of where my training comes from. But just in doing my research, I have become a participant observer. I have become, the first book grew out of my experience as a blogger. I was never a style blogger. I was never a fashion blogger, but I had a research blog that I was working on with a colleague and friend, Mimi Nguyen. But as we were doing this, as we were producing the content for this blog, I started becoming very interested in my own practices as a academic blogger, but also looking at how other Asian women and other Asian men and women would use their own personal blogs, right, to promote brands, et cetera, to promote their own style, identity, et cetera. And so a lot of it is me looking at, like, how am I interacting with social media? How am I interacting with, you know, whether it's the blogging platforms or how I'm even responding to, for example, Diet Prada's posts, right? Or how I'm responding to the latest kind of fashion trial by social media, how I'm responding to it, and also what I'm seeing, right? So there is, in some ways, there's also a lot of kind of discourse analysis. There's a lot of representational analysis too, I think, right? The ways that in which certain people are representing themselves as ethical consumers, shaming other consumers who might have bought, you know, Forever 21, for example, or the even what, you know, what people call the performativity, right, of social media, where like the promise to boycott fast fashion, the promise to boycott certain brands or to only buy other, you know, luxury brands, ethical fashion. And so kind of like the subtextual narrative in my book is that a lot of the popular understandings of what ethical fashion is or how to go about making fashion more ethical, I think is based on some real myths about what, for example, intellectual property is, right? Intellectual property is concerned with economics. It's not concerned, and it's not certainly not driven by ethical considerations for unequal power, right? That is not what intellectual property does or is interested in doing. And yet we call on, you know, in these fashion trials by social media, we call on intellectual property, and we assume that intellectual property, if not the law, at least its logics, are going to somehow make the market more ethical, right? And so then even the idea of ethics, right, the idea of what is ethical becomes a very US-centered but also very Western kind of concept that gets exported and circulates through ethical fashion movements, whether it's about, you know, knockoff fashion or whether it's about sustainability et cetera, right? These concepts, sustainability, ethical fashion, are very much Western based, but also, you know, very US and Eurocentric in a lot of ways. And I don't, you know, and it's frustrating to me, to be honest, that so much of sustainable fashion, ethical fashion movements are reproducing a lot of kind of Western notions of what life, what creativity, what health, what safety means.
Now, yeah, I would strongly recommend to all of the listeners to go out and get the book, because this is something so pertinent that we're dealing with today, right now, and also something that we have been somehow dealing with. It's current as well as very much rooted in history. It's the history you touch on in your text. I'm very curious to know what your next project is, as I'm sure at the end of the interview, all of the other listeners are. So could you tell us what you're working on now and what we can expect?
You know, that's as you know, because you're working on your dissertation, that's both a great question and a terrible question. I have a lot of ideas that I'm working on. I'm thinking about the supply chain. I'm thinking very closely about the supply chain and how the pandemic, multiple pandemics have impacted the supply chain. So I've written some articles on this. Whether or not it becomes a book is something that I'm thinking about. I'm also really interested in the kind of aestheticization of politics around sustainable fashion and ethical fashion. And so something about like the ways in which influencers, right, can produce an identity and produce a platform in which they become the leading voices of sustainable fashion, the sustainable movement, et cetera. And I'm kind of wondering like what's behind the screen, right? Like the content looks good, but what's behind there? And so thinking about the kind of aestheticization of politics. I'm also really interested in the ways in which recognized labor unions, particularly in Southeast Asia and South Asia, recognized labor garment labor unions maybe collaborate with state powers. Right. And so that we think of, we're pro-union, we want garment workers to unionize, we want to support garment workers to unionize. But unions themselves are political, they're not neutral, right? They're political, their formation is political. And the unions and the union representatives oftentimes that are allowed to have a voice and a platform are oftentimes the ones that are willing to work with the factory manager, are willing to work with the client, which is to say the Western fashion brand, willing to work with the state, right? And so in some ways, there's kind of the ways in which, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion programs in the United States have become defanged, right, in a lot of ways, because they've become kind of window dressing. I'm wondering about how formal unions and the kind of internationally recognized unions in Southeast Asia, in the Southeast Asian garment industries, are possibly harming garment workers who are like the most vulnerable garment workers, right? So I'm thinking about the garment workers that are not even on the payroll, right? Who are home workers, who are et cetera. So there's a lot of ideas that I'm interested in. But what will happen with any of these ideas is anybody's guess at this point.
No, all of those sound fascinating. I'll be looking forward to whatever next, whether it's an article or any kind of production of knowledge that comes out. I'll be looking out for that, and I'm sure others will too. Thank you so much, Dr. Pham, for joining us and for all of these insights. It was truly fascinating, and I genuinely mean that to speak with you. Once again, I am Lakshita Malik. This discussion of why we can't have nice things, published by Duke University Press in 2022, has been brought to you by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab in the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you so much for listening, and go out and get that book.